We inherently have knowledge within us that can bring about change for our people and can provide lifestyles and ways of being that are much healthier than what we have in the kind of colonized sense now.
I've always been the kind of guy that people start rumors about.
It's meant to be an entertainment. There's nothing more gratifying for me than to hear people laugh at it.
Name's Tony Parker. You must be Lance.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Canada's newest territory becomes its last to protect lesbo-gay rights. Indigenous New Zealand queers reclaim their pre-colonial sexuality, and soon-to-be camp classic Die Mommy Die oozes priestly charm. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Dean Elzinga.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending November 8th, 2003. A ban on sexual orientation discrimination this week squeaked through the Legislative Assembly of the Canadian Territory of Nunavut. The Eastern Arctic area was only organized as a territory in 1999, and so is the last Canadian federal jurisdiction to explicitly protect the civil rights of gays and lesbians. The Nunavut Human Rights Act, first introduced by the government a year ago, includes other protected categories. But it was only sexual orientation that divided the assembly members, and they spent a full 5 hours debating it. A proposed amendment to delete the controversial category was defeated 9-7 only after the assembly's law clerk advised the group that the courts would reinsert it. The final vote to adopt the Human Rights Act was 10-8. Along with the usual objections relating to seemingly endorsing homosexuality and confusing it with pedophilia, some opponents declared it to be a cultural issue for the native Inuit. But supporters countered there are Inuit gays and lesbians. Concerns were also raised about gay and lesbian marriages, although they are not part of the Territorial Human Rights Act. Premier Paul O'Callaghan told the Assembly the previous week that Nunavut will not be marrying same-gender couples until such time as pending federal legislation may require it. However, Nunavut will recognize gay and lesbian marriages performed elsewhere in Canada, currently in the provinces of Ontario and British Columbia, including handling their dissolutions in its territorial courts.
Another quirk of divorce law has emerged in the U.S. state of New Hampshire, where the state Supreme Court this week determined that a heterosexually married woman's lesbian affair does not constitute adultery there. The justices were divided 3-2 as they reversed a family court judge's decision. Unlike some other states, New Hampshire law lacks a definition of adultery. So the High Court majority relied on a Webster's Dictionary definition that referred to intercourse and on a case from 1878 that described adultery as intercourse from which spurious issue may arise.
Maine's Supreme Judicial Court issued an opinion this week that should clarify that lesbians and gays can qualify to legally co-adopt their partner's biological children. In the case of a lesbian couple who'd born a child through artificial insemination and an anonymous sperm donor, the court found that probate judges should consider only the best interests of the child when they rule on filings for co-guardianship status. While sending the specific case back to probate court, the state high court's opinion said it is not in doubt that the partner's bid could be legal.
A high-profile lawsuit filed by 7 gay and lesbian couples seeking equal marriage rights in New Jersey was dismissed by a trial court judge this week. Lambda Legal Defense and Education Fund, which is representing the couples, had always assumed the case was headed for the state Supreme Court, and so was pleased that the lower court decision came relatively quickly and will speed the appeal. The case could go next either directly to the high court or to an intermediate appellate panel. Lambda is arguing that the state constitution's guarantee of equal protection under the law requires equal marriage rights. Superior Court Judge Linda Feinberg rejected that argument and found that New Jersey law defines marriage as between heterosexual couples. She declared that it's up to legislators rather than the courts to change that. But she did explicitly urge New Jersey's lawmakers to carefully examine and consider the expanded rights afforded to same-sex couples in other jurisdictions.
Wisconsin's state Senate this week followed the Assembly in approving a bill to restrict legal recognition of marriage to heterosexual couples only. But Democratic Governor Jim Doyle quickly vetoed it. Doyle joins only former Colorado Governor Roy Romer and former Washington Governor Gary Locke, both Democrats, in vetoing similar measures. In fact, both Romer and Locke vetoed them twice. Doyle's veto message labeled the bill mean-spirited, redundant, and unnecessary.
Elections were held in some U.S. states this week with some positive results for gays and lesbians. The Ohio town of Cleveland Heights became the first in the nation to approve a domestic partners registry with a public ballot. In unofficial results, about 55% of voters supported the registry. The registry, expected to open early next year, will provide an official city record and a certificate to couples regardless of gender, but will carry no legal weight. Cleveland Heights City Council had previously made the suburb Ohio's first city to extend spousal benefits to the domestic partners of its civil servants, and had unanimously approved the petition to place the registry question on the ballot. Gathering signatures on that petition and stumping hard for passage was the group Heights Families for Equality. HFE had previously blocked a right-wing move for a ballot initiative to repeal the city's domestic partner benefits. The group had some financial and other support from the Human Rights Campaign and from the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, which is now encouraged to try a similar approach elsewhere.
Nationally, 16 of 24 openly gay or lesbian candidates backed by the Victory Fund Political Action Committee in races this week either won office outright or made the cut for runoff votes. Adam Eben became the first open gay or lesbian ever to be elected to Virginia's State House of Delegates. After winning a hotly contested Democratic primary, he ran without Republican opposition to represent a liberal Alexandria area district in that generally conservative state, which has only previously elected two open gays to local offices.
Ron Odin was elected the nation's first openly gay African-American mayor by voters in Palm Springs, California, beating out a two-term incumbent apparently by a margin of less than 3%. Despite its significant gay and lesbian population, Palm Springs has never before had either an openly gay or an African-American mayor. Palm Springs also voted open gay Steve Pugnay and open lesbian Ginny Fote onto its city council.
Also in California, open lesbian Ruth Atkin was returned to the Emeryville City Council. But in San Francisco's field of nine mayoral candidates, neither open gay Tom Amiano nor open lesbian Susan Liao made the cut for an upcoming runoff election.
In New York City, open lesbian Christine Quinn and open gay Philip Reed were both returned to the city council. In Suffolk County, New York, open gay John Cooper was returned to the county legislature.
In Michigan, open gay Craig Covey was returned to the Ferndale City Council.
In Georgia, open lesbian Keisha Cunningham was returned to the Decatur City Commission.
Open gay Tom Rasmussen defeated an incumbent to take a seat on the Seattle-Washington City Council.
In late October local elections in Israel, open gay Itai Pincus was elected to replace open lesbian Michal Eden on the Tel Aviv City Council. Eden was the first openly gay or lesbian candidate ever elected to a city council in Israel, and Pincus is only the second openly gay man elected to such office, following Sar Netanel in Jerusalem. Both had the support of the Meretz Party, and Pincus owes his success in part to a gay and lesbian community who turn out to vote in much stronger percentages than the general population.
And finally, conservative member of the British Parliament, Michael Portillo, who, while long married and avowedly faithful to his wife, has at least publicly identified himself as having been involved with men in his university years, announced this week that he'll leave politics rather than run in the next election, which will be no later than June 2006. Portillo's surprising assertion came as he turned down an offer to serve in the shadow cabinet of his opposition party under its newly chosen leader, Michael Howard. Portillo is still only 50, and his remarkable 20-year political career featured numerous predictions he'd someday be prime minister, even after his limited coming out.
He was a rising star under Margaret Thatcher and ultimately defense secretary under John Major. But in a shocking reversal that became emblematic of the labor revolution of 1997, Portillo lost his safe conservative seat in parliament to open gay Stephen Twigg. It was before undertaking his return to parliament from another truly safe seat 2 years later that Portillo made his vague coming out to reporters, knowing he'd be confronted with the question during his campaign. He was soon not only back in the parliament, but back in the Tories' shadow cabinet, despite becoming increasingly vocal in support of equal treatment for gays and lesbians, against the grain of much of the party. He nearly became the party leader in 2001, but lost out to the more conservative Ian Duncan Smith. In the wake of Smith's recent fall, Portillo did not even attempt to seek the leadership, certain he could not win it.
This week, Portillo said, I have lost my enthusiasm for the cut and thrust of politics. I do not know what I shall do after I leave, but I am keen to explore opportunities in the media, public bodies, and the arts. That likely means a return to creating TV documentaries, as he did in his previous hiatus from the Commons. Denying his announcement had anything to do with Howard's ascension of the day before, he also rejected the notion he was leaving a sinking ship. Instead, he declared in a TV interview, "The story is about how the Conservative Party is afloat again. The Conservative Party is certainly strong enough and sailing comfortably enough in the water that it doesn't need me to plug any gaps in its hull."
That's News Wrap for the week ending November 8th, 2003. Written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Dean Elzinga.
The Campometer reads off the scale for a drag diva's latest screen effort, while her Stark and Priestley co-stars are sending gay pulse rates skyrocketing. Our Steve Pride has a preview of this unusual new comedy later in the program. As New Zealand's indigenous peoples take on the task of recovering their cultural identities, the profound impact of colonization on everything, including traditional attitudes toward sexuality, becomes more and more painfully clear. This year, the first ever national research project on Maori sexuality was launched. The study is being conducted by, about, and for the Maori people themselves, and the researchers are determined to gain a deeper understanding of takatāpui, the Maori word for gays, lesbians, bisexual, and trans persons. University of Auckland lecturer and researcher Leone Piharmar, a Maori lesbian mother and one of the project leaders, talks with This Way Out correspondent Umakali Shakti about how and why Native peoples are reclaiming their culture.
Aotearoa New Zealand was colonized from the kind of late 1700s on. Our experience as Indigenous people has been fundamentally one of loss of land, alienation of culture and language, breakdown in terms of community structure, of an extended family system or a whānau system. So the impact in terms of sexuality is that we have had to deal with issues of the arrival of missionaries, the arrival of colonial beliefs and colonial understandings about how we are as women and men, the ways in which we relate. Colonisation itself has undermined in many ways, I think, the ways in which our people considered ourselves and our bodies and our relationships, our ways of being and our ways of interacting within tribal structures. In terms of the impact of that now, what we have, I think, is that we have a much less kind of ability to see sexuality in its fullest sense for Māori people, that we've tended, many of our people have tended to take on very controlled and limited ideas about who we are, about issues of sexuality and sexual preference.
And what was the motivation for yourself to get involved in a project like this and the other people who have got involved?
Project's led by four Māori people. My personal motivation is because I'm a Māori lesbian woman with three children. And, you know, I'm quite active in things Māori, and so I see more and more in our communities a need for us to come to understand sexuality and how it impacts on how we are with each other.
I think Indigenous people worldwide want to claim and do their own research.
Yeah, the whole idea of reclamation of our own knowledge is very powerful. Within Māori movements now, research is taking quite a big place in terms of recognising that we really are our own founts of knowledge. You know, we have our own knowledge base, and we need to find ways of actually bringing that forward again after a denial of Indigenous knowledge worldwide. And so there's the Māori language movement and the cultural movement. There's also a really strong knowledge, or mātauranga Māori knowledge movement, that's about saying we inherently have knowledge within us that can bring about change for our people and can provide lifestyles and ways of being that are much healthier than what we have in the kind of colonised sense now. So the knowledge issue is one. The fact that the team is made up of gay and lesbian and heterosexual Māori researchers who come from a really radical kind of approach. As a, you know, a Māori lesbian mother, you know, often those terms are seen as contradictory to each other, and you know, there's still that belief that to be a lesbian came with colonisation, you know, within our own community, so we need to deal with that issue. To be a lesbian mother is seen as, you know, an oxymoron for most people, and we need to deal with that issue. homophobia is rife within our communities and has a basis in real colonial understandings, very missionary-based.
And Christian-based, yes.
As a Māori lesbian woman, I mean, I have my own internalised homophobia, you know, that is a part of colonisation that I feel like brings up a whole lot of issues for me as well. And I think that if I'm having to deal with various ways in which I see sexuality as someone who's pretty, I consider myself to be pretty radical in my thinking and open in my thinking and always trying to decolonise, you know, how I approach things. For me, that indicates there are a lot of issues out there that we need to be dealing with. We have four of us who are like the senior principal researchers, and we all have come with our own reasons for being. The knowledge one is very clear. The language one is very clear. We're all either learners of or speakers of Māori.
That's the part of the fascination, because it's bilingual research, but also that language is not a static thing. So even within the English language, concepts around sexuality have been through huge changes, and language for it is changing. So true will be in the case of Māori, and also how language is spoken in the past and the understandings of it. So how are you going to deal with this bilingual, bicultural, as well as the historical process of language development under our understandings?
It's actually going to be in the language that we're going to find a whole lot of historical understandings. When I look at Māori language in relationship to the English language, which was much more dualistic and oppositional and limited often and constraining in how we define ourselves, I think there's much more fluidity in Māori language. All of the terms pretty well up for critique, whether they be Māori terms or English terms. I think that the English terms tend to be useful in a colonised context, but constraining or limiting, I think, in understanding Indigenous relationships.
Well, I think what's lacking totally is the whole notion of the spirituality and spiritual base within sexuality.
Yeah, well, I think colonisation, you know, one of its major impacts was to deny, you know, Wairuatanga or Indigenous spiritual being, because that is a lot about removing that connection, you know, of our own identities and our own well-being and the land and all of those interrelationships. So any project around Māori sexuality is actually, in my mind, is about exploring the many relationships that occur between peoples and our atua, you know, the spiritual beings of all the various realms of the land, of the sea. Because in actual fact, in many of the stories, you know, for lack of a better term, the kind of creation stories that we have in Māori, there are a lot of indications around sexuality and well-being in those stories, the way in which our people related, the way in which whānau, the kind of extended family systems, provide the basis for society and our roles within those systems. And when you remove a spiritual base, which I think has been a target of all colonisers around the world, then you remove quite a major essence of well-being and healing, you know, the healing possibilities. So we get left with this void. So anything that we do will be about interconnecting on all of the levels, taha tinana, the physical level, taha hininga, the intellectual level, taha wairua, you know, the spiritual level, all the various elements of who we are, taha whānau, which is the relationships level, so that we're continually engaging, thinking about understandings in those contexts. Key for us at the moment is really thinking about the Indigenous voice that exists already, whether it be literature written, whether it be spoken, getting an understanding of how other Indigenous peoples are talking about sexuality.
That was University of Auckland lecturer and researcher Leonie Piharmar in conversation with This Way Out correspondent Uma Kali Shakti.
Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded through direct charitable donations from our listeners, and we thank you.
To find out how you can help keep This Way Out on the air and get some queer audio history and timeless music in the bargain,
or for audio cassette subscription information,
please visit our website at thiswayout.org,
email us at tworadio@aol.com,
or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California 90038, USA.
Hi, this is Margaret Cho, star of Notorious CHO, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international radio magazine for all our sexually diverse communities.
Why not me? It's my moment. Let me be who I am.
Die, Mommy, Die is a parody which draws from the same well as last year's highly regarded Far From Heaven, but it may have more in common with last month's delightfully droll Girls Will Be Girls. It was written by and stars drag diva Charles Bush as Angela Arden, a songstress fallen from fashion. Directed by openly gay Mark Rucker, Die Mommy Die would qualify as a gay film on its camp credentials alone. But This Way Out's Steve Pride says Beverly Hills 90210 graduate Jason Priestley as Angela's bisexual lover and newcomer Stark Sands as her gay son steaming up the screen with him pushes it onto the queer must-see list.
The plot of Die Mommy Die is far too complicated to explain. All you really need to know is Charles Bush plays Angela Arden, a washed-up singing sensation trapped in a troubled marriage to a Hollywood producer. She has a daughter who hates her, a gay son who loves her, and a boyfriend who is secretly loving everyone. This generous gigolo is played to perfection by former Beverly Hills 90210 heartthrob Jason Priestley.
What about you, Tony? Have I paid enough for you?
You stop it right there. That's not funny. You know you're my girl.
Am I? You asked me to give up everything safe and secure for a man whose reputation is that of a highly paid gigolo.
I've always been the kind of guy that people start rumors about. Hell, it was a certain rumor about me that got you to reach for the phone in the first place.
Who are you, Tony Parker? You've slipped into my life as easily as vermouth into a glass of gin. Quickly and just a bit too smooth. Your life is a locked file cabinet of dark, ugly secrets.
What have you heard?
I have it on excellent authority, by way of every hair burner in West Hollywood, that the favors you've received are not only courtesy of the ladies, but les garçons as well.
What about the gay rumors? The ones that start with, I know someone who knows someone whose cousin is almost sure they saw Jason Priestley and Luke Perry making out in a gay bar.
Luke and I were never doing that. No. Those rumors were around about everybody. So it's fine with me. It doesn't bother me. The best postcard I ever saw, it was the Brandon doll and the Dylan doll, and they were kissing in front of the Hollywood sign. And it was a photograph that someone had set up with the two dolls and with the Hollywood sign in the background. It was very cool. And I bought five of them. There was five of them left. I bought all five of them. Sent them to all my friends.
In Die, Mommy, Die, Tony Parker has sex not only with Angela Arden, but with her son and daughter as well. And it's Priestley's scenes with newcomer Stark Sands as son Lance that bring the most sizzle to the screen.
I think he's beyond labels. Tony struck me as a guy who was willing to do whatever, whoever. He would use his sexuality, his powers of seduction, whatever way he could to get what he needed.
Nice breeze. Must feel good.
What are you doing on my lawn? Name's Tony Parker.
You must be...
Lance.
I'm here to offer my condolences to your mother. Isn't she back from the funeral?
After the service, there was a reception at Peter Lawford's agent's.
May I ask why you're not with the rest of your family?
That's none of your business.
You know, I skipped out on my old man's funeral. Ghastly, primitive ritual.
I don't like sad things.
We've met before, you know. Long time ago. At the Hacienda Club. Your father brought you around. I remember you in the locker room.
I remember you, too. You didn't wear a towel.
No need to be shy around other men.
I've watched a lot of Actors Studio, so I asked Jason, for scenes like this, how does an actor prepare?
We just kind of went in the shed there and just kind of did them. You know, Stark, I think this was his first or second movie, and he was great. He was always willing to play, you know, and that's really what you're doing in those kind of scenes. You're playing, and it's fun. And he was always up for it, no pun intended.
What are you doing here?
I was hoping to make things up to your mother.
Why are you hiding in the potting shed?
I wasn't hiding. I thought it was a safe bet your mother would be in here. It appears I was mistaken. Perhaps she's in the house.
Not so fast, sausage man. I've missed you. Miss me?
Yeah. How you been?
Baby can't sleep. Needs Tony. Needs him bad. Tony.
actor Stark Sands.
I try to keep myself in pretty good shape anyway, but there's no greater incentive to hit the gym than knowing you're going to be mostly nude in a film and immortalized because of it. So, I had a couple weeks where, I went into the gym. Who wouldn't, you know what I mean? The idea for this character is that he's supposed to be someone who's supposed to be sort of desirable. So I thought I might as well do everything I could to make it work. And man, the sun was in the right position that day because every time I see it, I'm like, oh my God, that's not me. There's no way, but somehow.
Thrown into a seasoned cast, newcomer Sands more than holds his own, no pun intended.
Mother, I told you a lie. Mm-hmm. I didn't come home because of an anti-war demonstration. They kicked my ass out of that college. Bastards. They said I was a bad influence.
On the other students?
On the faculty. They said I was a sexual magnet.
I imagine it was some predatory older woman.
Dr. Crenshaw's a man.
And you were alone with him?
Oh, not alone. There were 8 of them. The entire math department, in fact. The dean said... Well, he said I instigated a homosexual orgy in the faculty lounge. They found me being spun around nude on the Lazy Susan.
Recently interviewed for The Advocate by This Way Out fave, Dennis Hensley, the heterosexual Sands is grateful for his gay admirers.
I think it's great. You know, I didn't expect to be on the cover, to be honest with you. I was excited to do the interview because, like I said, this is a movie that Charles has got a built-in audience. And if it's a gay audience, that's great. You know what I mean? Like, everybody, fans are fans. And for me, I think it's fantastic. So it's funny that my first cover is on The Advocate with me and Barbara Streisand as the inset and two reality show guys wrapped in a single American flag. It's pretty classic, and it really is a great article, and any place to start's a good place to start for me. I'm pretty open.
In the film, Angela Arden's producer husband says his motto for making movies is make it big, give it class, leave them with a message. So what does Mark Rutger, the gay director of Die, Mommy, Die, want his audience to take away from this film?
I think that, for the most part, it's meant to be an entertainment. There's nothing more gratifying for me than to hear people laugh at it. And I've had that opportunity now a few times, and it's just a great, great feeling. But I do definitely think that there are things that I'd like people to sort of understand about tolerance and family and love, but I'm not sure that that's, you know, going to be foremost of their thoughts when they walk away from the film.
This has been a conversation with Jason Priestley, Stark Sands, and Mark Rutger. Die, Mommy, Die is a Sundance film series release. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
I learned by going where I have to go.
Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, Dean Elzinga, Graham Underhill, Fenceberry, Rex Walkner, Uma Kali Shakti, and Steve Pride contributed program material. Some of the music you heard was performed by Kaha and by Ruth Williamson from the Die, Mommy, Die soundtrack. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can also listen to This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. There's a link at our website, thiswayout.org. For associate producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on 4CCR Cairns, Queensland, WRUW Cleveland, Ohio, KDUR Durango, Colorado, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Kindly stay tuned.